It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Okay, so baking season is in full swing. We are hunting for the best of the best. We are going to hook you up with the minds behind the greatest pastry shops in the world. Think Paris. Our guide is French sweets expert Dori Greenspan, and she joins us with some dynamite recipes. Well, the Stearns have found the ultimate old-time grill man at Bob's in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Kitchen designer Deborah Krasner picks her all-time top design books. Food forager Ari Weinschweig talks the oils that get no respect. And then it's licorice. The backstory. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Now sit up straight, Kate. It's time to eat, Pete. Have a banana, Hannah. Try the salami, Tommy. Get with the gravy, Davy. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Try a tomato, Plato. Here's cacciatore, Dory. Taste the bologna, Tony. Everybody eats when they come to my house. I fix your favorite dishes, hoping this good food fills you. Work my hands to the bone in the kitchen alone. You better eat if it kills you. Pass me a pancake mandrake. Sample a taco paco. Have an hors d'oeuvre, Irby. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Hannah, Davy, Tommy, Dora, Mandrake. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Pasta, Fazula, Tallulah. Oh, do have a bagel, Fagel. Now don't be so bashful, Nashville. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Hey, this is a party, Marty. You get the cherry, Jerry. Now look, don't be so picky, Mickey. Everybody eats when they come to my house. All of my friends are welcome. Now, don't make me nag ya, mad ya. Eat the tables, the chairs, the napkins, who cares? Eat all my things if they gag ya. Have a frittata lata. Nibble a kibble, Sybil. Chili con carne for Barney. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Face, Busta, Cher, Chops, Thump. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Steak, cake, pie, side, juice, root, tart, bart. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Next Friday night, you're all invited to dance from 8 to 3. All the fishies in the sea are having a ball. It's some affair, they'll all be there from the herring to the whale. They'll turn out to shake a scale in Neptune's hall. Come along and follow me to the bottom of the sea. We'll join in the jamboree at the codfish ball. Lobsters dancing in a row, shuffle off to Buffalo. Jellyfish sway to and fro at the codfish ball. Finn and Hattie lead the eels through an Irish reel. The catfish is a dancing man, but he can't can-can like the sardine can. Tuna's trucking left and right, snappers tapping, what a night. There won't be a hook in sight at the codfish ball. Octopus and albacore, 50 miles away from shore. Tango cross the ocean floor at the codfish ball. Minnows dance the minuets, barracudas pirouette, while the stingray plays his clarinet at the codfish ball. Scottish salmon form a ring and dance the Highland fling.
The music's hot, so the lark starts trot, and the halibut is the jitterbug king. Sing it with me now!
Come along and follow me to the bottom of the sea. We'll join in the jamboree at the coffee ball. Lobsters dancing in a row, a shuffle on to buffalo. Jellyfish sway to and fro at the coffee ball.
Finn and Hattie lead the eels through an Irish reel. The catfish is a dancing man, but he can't like the sardine can.
Tuna trucking left and right, snappers tapping, what a night! There won't be a hook in sight at the coffee ball.
At the codfish ball. At the codfish ball. Da, 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 da.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and brought to you by Super Target. Well, just in time for the high baking season, we are bringing you the Great Bakers of Paris with French sweet expert Dory Greenspan. Yeah, we're mending fences, but politics aside, nobody does pastry better than the French. Kitchen designer Deborah Krasner names her all-time favorite design books. We have Sweet History, the story of licorice from caveman to medicine man. Food forager Ari Weinschweig talks the oils nobody knows, grapeseed, walnut, and hazelnut. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. The number's 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the road food column for Gourmet magazine.
Lynn, if you need a culinary challenge, we have one for you.
What kind of culinary challenge?
It is formally known as the Mega Bob Challenge, and it is offered by Bob's Drive-In of Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And here's what it is. If you can eat a 3/4 pound hamburger, 3/4 pound of French fries, and a cookie, plus drink 16 ounces of soda pop, faster than Jason Carpenter did it on March 7th, 2002, you get it all for free. Now, he did it in 5 minutes and 9.82 seconds.
How big is the cookie?
I like this. I like the handicapping, Jay. Let's get down
well,
to the
Well, it should
basics.
Be like a 3/4 pound cookie.
Yeah, it's a big cookie.
But if this guy does good food, I don't want to stuff it down in 5 minutes. I want to linger.
If you want to linger, then it's going to cost you all of $7.25 to eat the Mega Bob Challenge at your leisure.
Oh, my
goodness.
And
let me tell you, it's well worth it because even if you don't get the 3/4 pound Mega Bob burger, the normal size burgers in this place are really good. Nothing fancy, nothing bizarre about them. They're just good old style kind of coffee shop grilled hamburgers put on nice soft buns in such a way that the grease from the grill kind of imprints the bun just enough so that even that soft spongy bun is delicious.
Well, Bob is one of these old style grill masters. Grill Meisters, you know, that it's kind of the Bob show, and you sit at a counter, but the whole counter kind of is around Bob grilling and flipping burgers. And there's something very hypnotic and lovely about watching a really good grill man work.
Yeah, and you know, they're hiding them in kitchens now. And I agree with you. Where is this place again?
It's in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, on West 12th Street, which is one of the main drags of South Dakota. And it's a tiny, tiny place. I don't think there are more than 12 or 14 seats in the entire restaurant. You walk in, and it's, you know, a little bigger than a large walk-in closet. And it's kind of a curvy counter, sort of horseshoe-shaped, but double horseshoe. And everyone sits there. And it's one of those places where it is absolutely impossible to feel alone. When you're at the counter, you are part of a scene. And, you know, Bob is kind of the director of the scene. And everybody else sitting at the counter is part of it, too. And you can't help but feel part of the community.
And, you know, Lynn, Bob's, I think, well, I'd say he may be... he wants to outdo himself. I mean, so you don't think this is a little restaurant run by a little man. Mm. He specializes in also in cooking vast amounts of food for big takeout parties. And he has kind of a strange pricing system. You can get 90 pieces of roasted chicken for $81. So I don't know why it's not $80 or $85.
90 pieces for $81.
90 pieces for $81. Okay. 25 slabs of ribs for $117. And a whole roasted turkey for $23. I think Bob likes the odd pricing.
So does he serve all of these things? In addition to the burgers and the fries?
They are available in normal size portions. You can get ribs, roasted chicken. We personally like this place best at breakfast. Somehow there's something about a breakfast grill man at work that seems especially right. The way to watch him cook those hash browns and to flip them and get them nice and crusty but mm-hmm. not too burnt, put them on the plate along with just regular old toast, like buttered in a nanosecond. He has a way with that sort of spatula butterer. He'll take the toast and slap the butter on faster than you can see it.
And Bob's is also the kind of place where maybe 25 people sit at the counter and everybody talks to everybody. You cannot be anonymous there. There are people who are just kind of holding forth, you know, pontificating about life in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and other people are arguing with them, and other people are rolling their eyes, and Bob will put in the occasional mediating comment. So it's very much, dropping into the community of Sioux Falls. It's you really can't be anonymous there.
This sounds great. Okay, Bob's. And we'll watch him flip. Hey, thanks, guys.
Take the
operator.
Stick shifts and safety belts. Bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me. Not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me. Not way over.
The Stearns are the authors of the now classic Road Food. Now, every week you hear them here, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're cruising the site, don't miss signing up for our weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. Every week you get a new recipe for a fast supper dish, technique tips, and shopping info. And it's all free. So sign up on that website, splendidtable.org. Deborah Krasner is a kitchen designer who is always finding ways to make our kitchens more fun to be in. She's talked lighting, how to compost with a worm farm under the sink, and explained the canary test for nonstick cookware. Could there be more? Deborah, welcome back.
I'm thrilled to be here.
So what have you been mulling lately?
I've been thinking a lot about books that have meant a great deal to me over the years and how they really inform my sense of design, of kitchens, of houses. And a lot of listeners will already know what book I'm thinking of. It's called A Pattern Language by Christopher Alexander. And it came out in the 70s. And it's a book that has just profoundly influenced the way in which I look at kitchens and kitchen design and houses. Although, of course, people who haven't read it yet, I have to tell you, it will tell you how to plan cities. it's a huge book, and it really encompasses an enormous a span of material. But what it is the result of years and years and years of research all over the world by teams of people. Christopher Alexander is just the lead author. And it's an attempt to distill the patterns that people's houses take. And so each pattern is numbered and named, and you can kind of go through the book following threads of patterns. Mm-hmm. And they go like this: farmhouse kitchen, common area at the heart, communal eating, eating atmosphere, sunny counter, open shelves, cooking layout. Now, all of those patterns have different numbers and aren't necessarily consecutive, but each of them describes something really profound about kitchen design. So, for instance, if I just read you the summary of the farmhouse kitchen pattern, it goes, the isolated kitchen, separate from the family and considered as an efficient but unpleasant factory for food, is a hangover from the days of servants and from the more recent days when women willingly took over the servant's role. That's the criticism of the farmhouse kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he gives a prescription, it is, make the kitchen bigger than usual, big enough to include the family room space, and place it near the center of the commons, not so far back in the house as an ordinary kitchen. Make it large enough to hold a good big table and chairs, some soft and some hard, with counters and stove and sink around the edges of the room, and make it a bright and comfortable room.
So this is exactly what we see happening with kitchens these days.
It's true, except that we frequently see kitchens happening these days that kind of allude to these patterns but don't really take them in and hold them. For instance, we've seen lots and lots of great room kitchens, but they're not necessarily about comfort. They're frequently about, you know, show or efficiency or high tech. But the thing about Christopher Alexander's work is that it keeps on bringing us back to human scale and to relationships between people. It's really architectural ideas that are about wholeness and familyness and humanness and relationships. It's very, very interesting stuff.
All right, so that's pattern language. What else?
Well, there are a number of books that sort of are son of pattern language or daughter of pattern language. And one of the more obvious ones is called Patterns of Home, and it just came out last year. And what they've done is they've said instead of the 253 patterns that Alexander's book is based on, they have winnowed those patterns down to 10. Now, another daughter of pattern language is Sarah Sosanka's Creating the Not-So-Big House. Do you know about Sarah Sosanka?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, she's a phenomenon and very interesting because she's really defined houses in opposition to great big McMansions. She's really talking about craftsmanship, human scale, and making houses that really fit the way people live and that do double duty in lots of very interesting ways. And again, I don't think that her work could have happened without Alexander's work. So when I think about these theorists and these people who are really trying to distill the essence of what makes a house a home and then use that information to make a kitchen that really works for people, it's not so much that it's prescriptive, because, of course, the whole point of this is that your kitchen should fit you and not be an every person kitchen. But it's really about thinking about the people, making it human scale, making it beautiful to look at with beautiful materials that are really responsive to use.
It sounds so basic, but there's so much to know to do it. Hey, Deb,
that's right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Kitchen designer and food writer Deborah Krasner works out of her studio in Vermont. Her latest book is The Flavors of Olive Oil, which was on my list of top books from last year. This year, I've got another big three. First off, Tom's Big Dinners. It's by Seattle chef Tom Douglas. Now, he thinks like a home cook. Tom's recipes taste sensational. They're truly doable. My copy is already bristling with Post-its. Raw is probably the least home cook friendly book I have seen in years, but it's the most groundbreaking. It's by chefs Charlie Trotter and Roxanne Klein. Now, their food is vegan, stunning to look at, and revolutionary in its preparation. New has real meaning here. The Kitchen Detective is my third pick. It's by Christopher Kimball, and this is the book that tells you not only the how of the recipe, but the why. I have a bonus book. It's a novel, a brilliant one. It's about the fictional Vietnamese cook in the home of Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas. It is called The Book of Salt by Monique Truong. Well, coming up, the pinnacle dessert you can stash in your freezer, tasty oils nobody knows, and open lines for your calls. Reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. Thank you. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. It's Target, now available in food. At Super Target, you can find the foods and ingredients for your favorite recipes, plus the things you need to serve it up, all in one stop. When food editors need a baking expert who knows the French food scene from the inside out, they call Dory Greenspan. Now, Dory is the master of translating French pastry genius into recipes that we American home cooks can do. And if Dory isn't answering her phone, it's because she's at her second home, her apartment in Paris. This woman does her research firsthand. She's brought together her best finds in her book, Paris Sweets, Great Desserts from the City's Best Pastry Shops. Dory, good to have you back.
Nice to be with you again.
You know, Dory, it's the time of year just about everybody takes a shot at baking, but I'd like you to bring a little French into our lives. You know, I'd like you to tell us a little bit about French sweets.
French sweets are so glorious, but I'm giggling because while all of us in America bake this time of year, French people don't. They leave it to the pastry chefs. It's really interesting. Holiday time is fabulous in Paris, and it's fabulous because the pastry chefs go absolutely crazy. They put out their very, very best, and they put out surprises. They present special Christmas desserts. So you have very traditional kinds of Christmas desserts, and then you have every pastry chef's specialty for the season. And people order their Christmas desserts way ahead, but that doesn't mean they don't have to stand online. So it's really fun at Christmas time because the lines are almost as chic as the pastries in the window.
So it's a great time to people watch.
It's a great time to people watch and see what's in fashion and to see what's in fashion with desserts as well. You know, these days, the great pastry chefs in Paris are presenting their sweets the way fashion designers present their clothing. They actually have collections now. There's the spring-summer collection and the fall-winter collection. In fact, Pierre Hermé, who's considered the Picasso of pastry and was recently called the Karl Lagerfeld of macaroons, presented his fall-winter collection and said to me, you know what was so great? The desserts got applause.
Okay.
So, I mean, pastries are taken very seriously, and the French really appreciate them. And, you know, when I was working on Paris Sweets, I visited 17 pastry chefs and got to really meet them and work with them and hear their stories. And I also got to see the way they set up. And it's interesting because pastry, which so many people think is complicated, mm-hmm. is really an assembly line process. It's very, very easy when you think about desserts being components that need to get put together. And so it turns out that some of the most delicious, most sophisticated, and in some cases, most complicated desserts are really kind of do-it-yourselfers, you know, handyman specials, things that you can put together. And I get such a kick out of that. And I think it's such a great thing to keep in mind for the holidays because we're all busy and yet we all want to bake. And, I just found so many desserts that were so easy to do ahead. For instance, Pierre Hermé, again, our Picasso of pastry, makes a cookie that I think is just, it's my favorite cookie in the book. It's called Korova cookies. And Korova was the name of the milk bar in the Clockwork Orange in the movie. I know. And there was very briefly a restaurant called Korova. It was the hippest, hottest restaurant. Unfortunately, it wasn't hip and hot for too long. But Pierre made these cookies for them, and they were the house cookies at Korova. I now think of them as my house cookies. And it's a cookie based on a cocoa dough. It's a chocolate cookie, but it has big chunks of great chocolate, and I suggest you use the best chocolate you can get. And it has fleur de sel, that very, very special French salt in
right.
it.
Huh.
And the salt really, really brings up the flavor of the chocolate. It's just a great combination. And the best thing about these cookies is they're essentially slice and bake cookies. You make the dough, roll it into two sausages, pop them into the freezer. You can double the recipe, triple the recipe. I've six-tupled the recipe. I don't think that's the word, actually. And then just have these rolls on hand and slice them and bake them just the way you would something you bought from the supermarket. And this is, it's such a great cookie. And something that you can just do ahead for the holidays.
Well, you know, there's a classic that I love at the holidays. It's the beautiful little cakes called madeleines that are shaped like seashells. Can you do those ahead?
Actually, you should do them ahead. You shouldn't. Here's what you should do. Madeleines are, they're also my favorites as well. And the dough, the batter, actually, should be made ahead. You know the classic bump on a madeleine? One side looks like a seashell, and then when you turn it over, it's cute and puffy and plump, and it has a little bump in the center
right,
of it.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
The best way to get that bump is to let your dough rest at least 24 hours in the refrigerator. So these are really make-aheaders, and you can keep the batter up to about 4 or 5 days in the refrigerator, and you can make these a la minute, you know, at the last minute.
Uh-huh.
Have your pan, especially if you use these new flexi pans, the silicone pans.
Uh-huh.
You don't have to butter them. You don't have to flour them. You just put the little batter in. Why do I keep calling it a dough? It's really a batter. Put it into the oven, bake it, and you can have warm madeleines at Christmas time. It's fabulous.
So what about a classic French cake, a production number?
A production number.
Yeah.
You say that, and I think of the Showgirls with, you know, in feathers and plumes. You know, a great, great cake, and it is a production, and worth every little bit of effort, is the opera cake. This is really a classic. You see this in all of the great pastry shops. It's a chocolate and almond layer cake. Very, very thin layers. The cake is soaked in coffee syrup.
Mm.
Then it's layered with coffee buttercream.
Oh, my.
And chocolate ganache.
Oh, my.
And then it's finished with a chocolate glaze. It's always made in a square or a rectangle. And the recipe that I have for it is a big recipe. It'll serve 20. And the best part about this is every one of those elements can be made ahead. And this is really the best part. The entire cake, all put together, gorgeous, glorious, glazed, can sit in the freezer ready to go.
You mean all I have to do is pull it out of the freezer?
That's it, sweetie.
Oh.
It's so great. And it's really a showstopper. It's a fabulous cake. So you can make it in pieces when you've got time, make the cake, make the buttercream, make the ganache, put it together. And then, and also, you know what? Every time you open your freezer, you'll smile.
Oh, bless the sneaky French. I love it. Thanks, Dory.
It's been great talking to you, Lynn.
Dory Greenspan is author of Paris Sweets, Great Desserts from the City's Best Pastry Shops. Now, there is no way that we are going to let this woman leave without giving us recipes for those chocolate cookies called Korovas or that showstopper opera cake. You can find them on the website, splendidtable.org. We're wired for sweets. Mother Nature made poisonous plants bitter and good-for-you stuff sweet. You know, like mother's milk and fresh fruit. Well, it's not a long leap from mother's milk to munching Milky Ways in front of the TV. British writer Tim Richardson is a self-confessed candy addict. He writes for newspapers, magazines, and he's author of Sweets, A History of Candy. Tim, welcome.
Hi, Lynn. Hi.
Tim, I'd like to talk about licorice because I think it's sort of the entry-level candy for everybody. Where did licorice come from?
Well, the licorice plant is a shrub called Glycyrrhiza glabra. There are more species than that. There are about 15 of them, but that's the one with a woody stem and roots which contain a substance that's about 50 times sweeter than sugar. Although, as you know, when you actually bite into a woody stick of licorice, it doesn't taste that sweet because there are lots of other competing flavors in there.
Uh-huh.
So this has been used really since antiquity. The Egyptians had a drink called maisus, which was a licorice drink. The Roman legionnaires used to chew licorice when they were on long marches because it was felt that it gave you stamina. It's mentioned by the Greeks and so on, and has been used in sweet making really throughout the Middle Ages as well as a pharmaceutical item.
You said something when we had a conversation a while ago about an almost alcoholic drink made from it that's still drunk today.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is a little informal thing that kids do. I mean, I remember doing this, is you got a little piece of licorice, put it in a bottle. Maybe some of your listeners did this too, and with some water, and you shook it up, and it made a kind of drink, a brown drink, which no adult would touch, I'm sure. Anyway, you used to drink this, and it was, because licorice has got an almost, it's not alcoholic, but it's got a sort of alcoholic savour to it, hasn't it? A very black savour. Yeah. I remember drinking that, and I was very struck when I was researching the book, finding in a medical treatise of the 1650s, a reference to kids doing this. Exactly this, putting it in a glass bottle and shaking it up and drinking it. So kids for, you know, for 400 years have been doing that, 300 years have been doing that. So I like that.
I think you may have just started something in the United States. But does every country eat licorice?
Yeah, but everyone has got a slightly different taste. In America and in the UK, we tend to like our licorice quite sweet. That's how I like it anyway. But if you go to Scandinavia or Germany or most extraordinarily to Holland, you're going to have salty licorice. The licorice comes in all different grades of saltiness. And there's an extreme salt one, which is almost inedible to me anyway. Quite a good middle ground of saltiness and sweetness is the Italian style of licorice, which are small pellets, very concentrated pellets of licorice, which give you a real licorice hit without being too salty.
I always heard that it helped your stomach, it helped you digest, and you'd let some licorice, you know, just dissolve in your mouth and you'd feel just swell. And I don't know if there's any truth to that or not.
Yeah, I mean, it has always been used. I mean, in the West, I guess it's traditionally been used as a balm for coughs. And it was also used for curing stomach ulcers in the medieval period. Uh-huh. And it's, in Chinese medicine, it's a real staple along with ginseng. It comes up all the time in Chinese medicine, and it's a tonic for the heart and for the spleen, ulcers, colds, and also skin disorders in Chinese medicine. So it's got many, many applications. I mean, all I know is it tastes really nice. And I'd like any excuse to eat it, frankly.
Can you give us some brands to try so we have a sense of the variety?
Yeah, well, I mean, I suppose why not start with my favorite? One of my favorite sweets of all time is something called Licorice All Sorts, which are made by a British firm called Bassett's. I don't know. I think you could probably certainly get those over the internet. But for me, they're the most beautiful sweets of all. They're like little sandwiches of licorice in multicolours. Finnish licorice is the saltiest. And the main brand there is Panda. And you can get that in health food shops. I mean, it does taste a little bit as if it's, you know, good for you. And Dutch licorice, that, you know, that comes in millions of different shapes, and I'd advise you to have a look at those. I mean, you can get, you know, ship's ropes, ship's wheels. The most famous one, the classic one, is the Catches Kinder, they're called, cat-shaped licorice. So I'd suggest trying those.
Okay. Hey, Tim, thanks.
Thank you.
Journalist Tim Richardson is author of Sweets, A History of Candy. Ari Weinschweig sells food. He's one of the forces behind Zingerman's, that little mecca of high-quality mail order and deli based in Ann Arbor. But Ari is also one of the food world's outstanding foragers. I've watched him track down not only the where of the good stuff, but the why of it. Well, Ari's put all this information in his first book, Zingerman's Guide to Good Eating. Ari, good to have you back.
It's good to be back, Lynn. Thank you.
Ari, I'd like to talk about oils other than olive oil, but starting with grapeseed oil. What's the deal? Why is grapeseed oil so expensive?
Well, it's expensive, I'm sure, just because it's a lot of grapeseeds that go into producing a liter of oil. But I think that for me, it's something that I've really never recommended to our customers and really not used much. I know a lot of people write about it and recommend it for its high smoke point and, you know, but to me, it's always been a very expensive way to get a high smoke point into your cooking without really any flavor. So One thing that we've just discovered in the last year, actually thanks to Odessa Piper, who runs L'Etoile in Madison, which is a great restaurant, she turned me on to a very small producer in Germany of a cold-pressed Riesling varietal grapeseed oil, which has destroyed all of my negative images about grapeseed oil, and which I love. I've been using it for salads, for fish dishes, on potatoes, all sorts of things, and it's really outstanding.
What does it taste like?
Well, it's got a really fruity, I mean, almost apple-y taste, a little bit spicy, maybe you could say, grapey. It's you know, it's a whole different set of flavors, I guess, really, than anything I've been used to. And it's really best to me on dishes, as a, like olive oil, you know, I love to just kind of eat it with bread or make bruschetta. But with this, I found that it's really best in a salad. I've been doing it a lot with some blue cheese. We've been getting some really great the Crozier Blue from Ireland, or good Roquefort, and putting that on a salad and tossing it with some of this oil and a good vinegar. That's been really great. I know Odessa told me she uses it with raw scallop. It's really quite fantastic.
So regular grapeseed oil is tasteless, and and you could cook it to a high temperature, but it gets real pricey. So this sounds like something worth trying.
Yeah, I think the data that they gave me is about 50 kilos of seeds from the Riesling grapes to produce a liter of oil. So
that's 100 pounds.
Yeah.
100 pounds.
It's not a small production in that sense.
You need a lot of grapes for that. Well, let's talk nut oils. Walnut oil and hazelnut, and do they really taste of the nut, and how do you judge them?
Well, I think the answer to the first question is the same as the second question, really, because the best ones do taste of the nuts, and that's how you judge them. If they don't taste really, I think, distinctively and pleasingly of the nuts, then you're probably not tasting a great nut oil. So, I mean, the best walnut oils or hazelnut oils to me are very toasty, they're very rich, and they're very aromatic. There are a lot of them on the market that are sort of a pallid flavor. I mean, there may be a little hint of a walnut in there somewhere, but not something that really grabs you. And my experience of the best walnut, hazelnut, almond, whatever, nut oils, they're very toasty, they're very intense, and they're very delicious.
Can you name some names?
I can. My personal favorite comes from France. The brand is Le Blanc. It's a small family production. They still toast all of the nuts. They use, again, only whole nuts, which, you know, as opposed to using leftovers or pieces that weren't good enough to use for something else. And then they stone grind. And what you get is, again, very toasty, very aromatic, and really quite delicious. Like the best olive oils, you really want to use them mostly at the end of the dish. So, you know, I might drizzle it over potatoes or over fish or lamb, you know, at the end, as opposed to using it to fry or cook in.
Now, do they do the walnut and the hazelnut and the almond and all of that?
They do. All of those. There's also some nice pecan oil that's being made in this country by the California Press folks that uses a Native American nut.
How do you store these oils?
Well, once they're open, I always keep them in the refrigerator. Unlike olive oil, where you don't need to do that, really, they do tend to turn fairly quickly, so it's important to keep them cold.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Ari.
Thank you.
Ari Weintraub is author of Zingerman's Guide to Good Eating. You can get his oil picks on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, it's time for the weekly trivia challenge. Now, here's the question. What is the latest thing to get wired in your kitchen? And we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International.
Thank you.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. It's Target, now available in food, where you can find the expected and unexpected, aisle after aisle, online at target.com/supertarget. Well, now, we're going to be taking your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. The question was, what is the latest thing to get wired in your kitchen? It's the refrigerator. Coming to your neighborhood soon is the internet fridge. This wonder appliance will have a computer, a writing pad, a video camera, microphone, speakers, and a DSL jack. You can order from an online grocer from the door of your fridge. You can leave video messages for your family. The Italians are working on a refrigerator that tracks its contents and emails you at the office when, for instance, the kids have finished the milk. Of course, when the Internet Home Appliance Consortium asked consumers about their takes on such wonders, the response was, "What were you thinking?"
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me.
The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to those phones. We've got Mary on the line. Hey, did you have a question?
Yes, actually, and this is going to sound kind of strange, but some weeks ago I got this catalog. It's Tomato Grower Supply Company catalog.
Right.
And the description for one of the tomato varieties is called Giant Belgium.
Uh-huh.
It says that they're so sweet that you can actually make wine out of them.
That sounds awesome. What an interesting thing. Not jam, right?
Not jam.
Not ice cream sauce, but wine.
And it sounded, it's like, I'm thinking, my gosh, that would be so awesome with, like, beef or anything like that.
A tomato wine, you mean?
Yeah.
And is, so your question
is? I was just wondering, do you guys happen to know of any tomato wine recipes?
And lamentably, I've come across them. Now, I say this because I got fascinated with this idea because, you know, for years, all over the world, people made alcoholic beverages from whatever they had handy.
Uh-huh.
There is actually out there somewhere a recipe for cabbage wine.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, exactly the reaction. It is awesome. I have to tell you, you never want to have it pass through your lips more than once, I think, from reading it. But the tomato wine recipes, if I'm remembering correctly, are usually an awful lot of sugar with tomato.
Okay.
Because, you see, sugar is what ferments into alcohol.
Uh-huh.
So it's usually a lot of sugar. There's always raisins. And raisins are constant, like, you know, in cucumber wine or whatever, because raisins, again, help the fermentation to start.
Uh-huh.
And there's usually yeast. And there's usually spices of some kind or citrus of some kind. That's what I'm remembering. I'm also remembering some that sound like they are very bad science experiments where you put, no, because I remember things like you put all kinds of strange sounding tablets into them and then you have sort of a distillery going in the basement. In short, uh-huh. What I know about tomato wine is really that it sounds pretty god awful.
Well, I could think it would probably be wonderful in things. It's like a recipe ingredient.
Well, you know, maybe it would be. You know what I'd rather do, though, if you've got really sweet tomatoes? Why not make a great tomato jam? I mean, tomato jam can be fabulous, and you can throw spices in it and whatever. But if you want to try tomato wine, I'd say go on the internet, take a look, and generally what you're going to find is a little bit of yeast, a lot of sugar, a lot of tomatoes, citrus, and then you let her rip.
Okay.
And don't seal it until after it stops fizzing, otherwise you'll have it blow up.
Okay.
Hey, thank you. This is opening up a whole new world for everybody.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Hey, you take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. If anybody calls about Brussels sprout wine, I'm drawing the line. You got it, guys? Okay. 800-537-5252.
52. We have Greg calling from Wichita, Kansas. Hey, Greg, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I've got a question about turkey.
Uh-huh.
From what I can tell, most of us eat turkey on Thanksgiving and maybe Christmas. We eat leftovers for a couple of days. But in spite of the fact that the turkey is absolutely delicious and it's high in protein and low in fat, just those one or two occasions, and then that's it for most of us.
Right.
What I want to know is no, I'm not really talking about leftover recipes or substitute recipes. Are there some great recipes out there that you know of, or maybe some others, that don't require roasting the whole bird, don't require a commitment of an entire day, that you know, and they're not substitutes. They're turkey for turkey's sake. Seems like a great meat that just kind of is forgotten in there, but this time of year I got to thinking about it.
Oh, Greg, you called the right woman.
Well, I had a feeling. I listen to you all the time, and I had a feeling if anybody would know, you would.
Well, the reason is it's my husband, because he loves bird.
Oh, okay.
And so we do a lot with bird, whether it's chicken or turkey or whatever. I'll tell you what I love. I'm a wing person.
Mm-hmm.
Now, turkey wings tend to be tough unless you know what to do with them, but this is the kind of thing that's so easy. You can throw them in, you know, plastic bags in the fridge.
Right.
And you put your favorite barbecue sauce or your favorite marinade in that bag, and you forget about them for a day.
Have you already cut them up, or are they?
No. I leave these puppies whole.
Okay.
Yeah, I just go for it whole, and I just fill bags with them, and I throw in the you know, whatever I want to marinate them in, and then what you do is you spread them in a big roasting pan, and you cover them with foil, and you have some of that marinade on them,
mm-hmm.
and you put them in a 325 degree oven. Covered with foil, completely sealed, because you got to tenderize them.
Right.
So you roast them for about an hour, maybe an hour and a half, until you can stick a fork in them and you can see they're tender.
Mm-hmm.
Whip off that foil, all right? Just whip off that foil, flip on that broiler.
Okay.
Now watch carefully, because this is where you can turn them into cinders, and I have done this. But the idea is you want to broil them about 3 minutes on one side, maybe 3 minutes on another, turn them with tongs, and you have turkey wings you can eat with your fingers.
Mm.
Absolutely fabulous.
That sounds great.
Unbelievable.
Now, you have a name? You just call them turkey wings?
We just call them, we can't get enough of them.
and
seriously, you know what I do? We make big batches and we'll have them hot the first night. I stick them in the fridge. We then cut them up. But they're great cold because you've marinated. You know, I mean, they're just dynamite. And they're cheap. And by the way, turkey wings make the best broth you could imagine. Now, you can take turkey thighs, which are often sold independently,
mm-hmm.
okay, and you can sort of make them like osso buco. You cut them in half. I mean, you mm-hmm. take out the bone,
right.
and you just cut them in like slices, and then you kind of just, you know, tie them with a string so they're little flat rounds.
Right.
And you braise them. You follow any osso buco recipe. You know, you braise them because they're imagine them being superbly moist stew meat.
Right.
So you can do any stew recipe with that, but especially osso buco, where you brown them in olive oil, and then you have celery, carrot, and onion, and white wine, and
you
let
them
breathe.
Would you dust them with the flour first?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. You got the right idea.
Mm.
You could also take out that bone, because it's just one bone in the thigh,
right.
and the thigh is big. You could put your favorite stuffing in that, roll them up, tie them mm-hmm. with string, or just put some toothpicks in and slow roast.
Oh, that sounds great. And, you know, that's kind of the thing, too, because in other parts of times of the year, I think part of what you might miss is just that whole Thanksgiving deal. So you could stuff them with some stuff that maybe
right.
had a little sage or something.
That's
in
right.
it.
Exactly. It's a mini turkey for two people.
Oh, that's a great idea.
It's very, very simple. So think of the parts. Start looking at the parts of the bird. And by the way, I think they usually go for next to nothing. I mean, they're really economical and they're good. They're really good.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I get to thinking now, you know, how good it is on Thanksgiving, but that's just yeah, you know, it's kind of the forgotten bird.
Well, I think it is, and I think because it's so big.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 16 pounds of anything is a little hard thing to deal with on a day-to-day basis. But
yeah,
go turkey, Greg. You're going to have a blast.
Oh, yeah, and if you hear a funny sound, that's me drooling on the phone here. So.
Hey, it usually short-circuits the mic, so I can't do it while we're on the air. Hey, thank you so much. You take care.
Thank you, Lynn.
Okay.
Bye.
Goodbye. Just think of the turkey as, you know, the thigh is like a little roast, okay, or stew meat, and the leg is the same way, and the breast, well, the breast is white meat. You can slice it and make it into scallops, you know, or cutlets. It's very easy.
537-5252. We tell all. We've got Susan calling. Susan is calling from St. Louis, Missouri. Susan, welcome to the show.
Oh, Lynn, I'm so excited about the possibility that you might answer this age-old question for me.
All right, we're ready. I'm putting on the age-old answer cap.
It's not age-old, but it's been petrifying me. Every time I see the term salt to taste, I don't know what to do, and I always undersalt. I think I learned to cook from my mother at a time when she was trying to help my father's blood pressure drop by taking salt out of everything she cooked. I cook a pot roast often, for instance,
right,
and half of the time I get it right. Nobody at the table adds salt. And the other half of the time, the salt shaker is nearly empty by the time they...
Right, right. One thing I learned, my mom lived with us, and she had a problem where she couldn't have salt. And I just stopped using it, except my husband and I would salt at the table. And boy, I learned something really amazing. We were using 3 and 4 times the amount of salt that I normally would have put in that dish, because when you salt at the end, for some reason, you just need a heck of a lot more to get the taste. Whereas I was used to, you know, let's take your pot roast, for instance. Does it begin with you browning the meat?
Yes.
Okay. If you lightly sprinkle the entire surface with salt before you brown or as you brown. Okay. If you get the salt in the early stages of cooking, you will use far less. You have a 3-pound roast. You're going to do pot roast? Is that?
Yes.
Okay. I would start out with 1/4 teaspoon of salt.
Okay. 1/4 teaspoon.
A quarter of a teaspoon of salt. Yeah. Okay. For about 3 pounds. You could even use a little bit less because, you know, I sprinkle. Because there's two sides to this. I mean, one is if you go too far, then you're really in trouble. You can always add more through the cooking. But the other thing is, if things taste right to you, give your people the option at the table.
Okay.
But if you start out 1/8 to 1/4 teaspoon, let's play it really safe, 1/8 to 1/4 teaspoon of salt for that 3-pound roast, and then you take it from there.
And do you think it's any different if I'm using chicken or
No, I think the difference would come, let's say, with a ham, for obvious reasons. It has a lot of salt in itself, or sausage, or that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd say if you start out with 1/8 teaspoon and then work your way up to 1/4, you're right in the ballpark.
Oh, I'm so happy. Thank you so much.
You are welcome.
My family will really appreciate you.
Well, just tell them, too. You know, we all have different flavor. We all taste differently. We all perceive flavor differently. So no right or wrong here.
Thanks so much.
You are welcome.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. You know, it's really interesting because when you watch professional chefs cook, especially with salt, you see that layering is involved. Let me give you an instance. You're going to grill a piece of fish. Well, the first thing a chef is going to do to it is give it a light sprinkle of salt before it goes on the grill. You put it in the pan or on the grill, very light sprinkle of salt, and you sear it and you start to cook it and maybe you add some other ingredients. Well, you taste. You take a little taste. You may find that things are kind of flat. You give it just a tiny bit of salt then. And the idea is that just as we add different ingredients to a dish at a different time, and that helps build different levels of taste, that's how it works with seasoning as well. But do remember this. Wait and add the salt only when you're finished with the dish, and it never tastes quite right. It just tastes different. And I think it's because the salt actually works its way into some of the foods and you perceive them differently. So a little salt at the beginning, and then as you cook the dish, you might want to add a little more and a little more. Call us 800-537-5252. Every year, a quiet letter arrives from a man who grows fruit, and it has a list of his offerings, his dried fruits. But what a list. It's the who's who of great-tasting peaches, nectarines, plums, apricots. Well, each year, this is my Christmas present to myself. I've wanted to talk with fruit grower Art Lang for a very long time. Well, finally, we have him on the phone. Art, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Anne.
So how are you? And has it been a really busy year for you?
Every year seems to be busier. Production was not up this year, but I guess farmers always say that. Some of our varieties didn't produce very well, but I have a large number of varieties, about 200. so I'm bound to have some fruit every year.
Yeah, how many trees do you have? Because you do have this long list of many kinds of nectarines and many kinds of peaches and apricots. I mean, how many trees are there in the orchard?
I have about 7,000, but...
Oh, boy.
That's still a small production. I'm only 17 acres is what I own, and I farm about 16 of them.
How did you start doing the dried fruits?
Well, I used to dry the conventional way, and I sell at farmers markets. And I got so much objection to the sulfur that I came up with this method of drying fruit without sulfur, which has been very successful.
But what are you excited about now? Is there are there some new things in the orchard that you like, or is there something that...
Yeah, I'm always trying new varieties. I have a couple of acres where I just try new varieties. And, of course, we usually end up drying them. Like the other day, we had never dried any Asian pears. We started drying them, and gosh, they come out really good. Same thing with citrus. It was so successful that I can't produce enough from my small production to keep up with the demand. I don't think it's as good as the white nectarines. I think they're the best product I have, but... Some of my customers don't agree. They just seem to be fascinated by these crunchy, highly intense flavored citrus.
Well, Art, thanks for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you. Bye.
Goodbye. Dr. Art Lang raises and dries his fruit on his Honeycrisp farm in California. For information on his wares, go to the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Now, until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Deborah Papier. She wrote, "For months they have lain in wait, and now they are upon us, sodden with alcohol, their massive bodies bulging with strange green protuberances, attacking us everywhere. There is no escape. It is the hour of the fruitcake." The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. Everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And be sure to take a look at our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. Register for it on the website. It's easy, it's fun, and best of all, it doesn't cost anything. Our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Sarah Lear and Judy Graham. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week. Join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Public Radio International.